This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The stock market is rigged, according to our first guest, Michael Lewis. His new book, Flash Boys, explains why. It's about the form of computerized transactions known as high-frequency trading, in which the fastest computers with the most high-speed connections get the information first and make the trades before anyone else can. A nanosecond can make all the difference between how much money is made or lost on any transaction. You'd be surprised to hear what investment banks do to get that nanosecond edge and how they often use it in ways Lewis describes as predatory. The FBI, Wall Street regulators, and New York's Attorney General are investigating high-frequency trading and whether it has created an uneven playing field. Michael Lewis is the author of several books about the stock market, including Liar's Poker and The Big Short. He also wrote the bestseller Moneyball, about how computer analytics is changing baseball. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Michael Lewis, welcome back to Fresh Air. So, you see, the image of the stock exchange with traders hollering on the floor, that really hasn't existed in reality in several years. The markets, you say, trade inside black boxes in heavily guarded buildings in New Jersey and Chicago. What are those black boxes? What are those buildings?
Well, the most sensational building is the New York Stock Exchange building in Mahwah, New Jersey, which it's a fort. You need to get to it. You go through guards and German shepherds, and inside the building is the place where buyers and sellers meet on the New York Stock Exchange, not on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. There are no human beings. It's just signals going into a box, computer signals. The building is enormous, and the question is, sort of, why is it so big if the exchange is now just a box instead of thousands of people shouting at each other? And it's enormous to house the equipment of all the high-frequency traders who want to be near the exchange so they can get information from the exchange more quickly than you or me.
Okay, when you say more quickly than you or me, it sounds like there's a messenger running from the exchange to the office of the broker, which is exactly not what's happening. How do you get the edge in terms of time of getting it a nanosecond before the other people do?
It's a couple of millisecond edge they're usually looking at. And the way you do it is to minimize the physical distance between you and the actual exchange so that the cord that connects your box that is making your trading decisions, you the high-frequency trader, that leads to the actual exchange is just shorter than everybody else's cord. And high-frequency traders pay the exchanges vast sums of money to be close to the exchange so they can get the signals from the exchange before everybody else.
And these signals are traveling on fiber optic lines.
Correct. So it's a matter of physics. I mean, there's a light traveling over distance still takes time. It's time that's kind of incomprehensible to the human mind. But to a trader in the stock market now, the difference between getting the information in 3 milliseconds as opposed to 4 milliseconds is the difference between knowing the prices before everybody else and not.
And why does that give you the edge?
Well, if I get price changes before everybody else, if I know a price is going up or going down before you do, I can act on it. If you're coming in to buy, you know, the shares in Procter & Gamble and you think the price is 80 and you're saying I'm going to buy Procter & Gamble for $80 a share and I'm sitting there as a high-frequency trader and I know that the price of Procter & Gamble is actually lower, it's 79. I can buy it at 79 and sell it to you at 80. And it's hard to get your mind around because the time advantage of a high-frequency trader is so small. It's literally a millisecond or two. It takes 100 milliseconds to blink your eye, so it's a fraction of a blink of an eye. But that, for a computer, is plenty of time.
So the central figure in your book is Brad Katsuyama, who was working with the Royal Bank of Canada when he became the head of electronic trading. And once he gets into electronic trading, things start happening that he just doesn't understand.
So can I back you up?
Yes.
Brad Katsuyama is the head of just stock trading at the Royal Bank of Canada in New York. He has 25 traders working for him. He deals in hundreds of millions of dollars of shares every day. He takes risk in the market. And in early 2008, he senses something's wrong. And what he senses is that when he looks at his trading screens, which has the prices of stocks in the market, and the stock market's no longer in one place. There are 13 different public exchanges that trade, say, the stock of Microsoft or the stock of Apple Computer. So his screens will tell him, say, that there are 10,000 shares of Microsoft offered at $30 a share if he wanted to buy them. And normally, up to this point in his life, if he hit his button, he'd get the 10,000 shares for $30 a share. But all of a sudden, when he hits the button, the shares disappear. It's like someone knows he's trying to buy Microsoft, and the price of Microsoft goes up before he can get it. And he doesn't understand why this is happening. And that's the beginning of the story. It's sort of like all of a sudden, the market he sees on his screens, which is the market every professional trader and even someone who's sitting at a Schwab terminal or an E-Trade terminal would see on their screens, becomes this kind of illusion.
So why are the shares that he's trying to buy disappearing as soon as he hits buy?
You ask that question so facilely. It takes him 18 months to get to the bottom of it. 18 months with some of the most sophisticated minds on Wall Street working with him to answer that simple question. Why are the shares disappearing? Why does someone seem to know what I want to do before I do it? And it may only cost me a few pennies a share each time this happens, but over the billions of shares that are traded in every day on the stock market, it adds up. So he goes looking. And he starts to sort of test the market with funny kinds of experiments. The short answer is, what turns out is happening is he's sitting physically in Lower Manhattan when he makes his trades. When he pushes the buy button, the signal from his computer travels up the fiber optics along the West Side Highway of Manhattan and through the Lincoln Tunnel. On the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel is one of the 13 stock exchanges called the BATS Exchange, founded by high-frequency traders. They're sitting there, and they get the signal that he wants to buy first. And they have faster connections to the 12 other exchanges that are scattered across New Jersey. And they race him to the other exchanges, buy all the Microsoft in front of him, and sell it back to him at a higher price. So what was happening is he was physically being raced by high-frequency traders who had faster and more direct fiber optic lines from the first exchange to all the other exchanges. But it takes him literally 18 months to figure this out, and it has to assemble people who, you know, have been essentially in manholes in New Jersey laying fiber optic cable to figure out how all this works.
So say the bank, an investment company that he was with, represented my retirement fund.
Mm.
What would that mean for me?
It would mean for you that every time your retirement fund trades in the market, some high-frequency trader is skimming pennies from each trade. And it adds up to, who knows, 10, 20, no one quite knows, many billions of dollars a year. It's essentially a tax on your investment dollars. So you're essentially being legally robbed from by the system. And that's just really the beginning of the problem. I mean, the beginning of the problem is you're paying this unnecessary tax to Wall Street to make trades in the marketplace. The bigger problem is that the system, in order to accommodate high frequency trading, has become ever more complicated. In fact, it's almost designed so you can't understand it, so you don't ask questions about it. But the complexity brings with it instability. I mean, that making these systems that run the stock exchanges ever more complicated and ever faster for the benefit of high-frequency traders creates a kind of volatility to them. So you have flash crashes. You have outages of stock exchanges. You have stocks doing very strange things. So the bigger problem, in addition to the skimming that's going on of your investment, of your savings, is that there's a decline of trust in the marketplace because it's not as trustworthy. And if it's not as trustworthy, then the whole economy suffers. I mean, the trust is sort of the grease that keeps the system working.
So let's get back to Brad Katsuyama. And he's, again, the central figure of your book, who is at the Royal Bank of Canada when he figures out that something's going on that he doesn't comprehend. He assembles a team of experts from all over who have dealt with high-frequency trading, and together they figure out what's going on, and then they try to circumvent it, and they create something called Thor. What is Thor?
So Thor is a stock market order router. It sends the orders out into the market to the 13 different exchanges from Brad's computer terminal. So The problem he was having was that when he hit his button and sent his buy order or his sell order into the market, it arrived at different exchanges at different times because the exchanges were physically located at different distances from his desk. And it takes time for a signal to travel through fiber optics. So it would get to an exchange on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel first, and then it would get to the other exchanges later. With Thor, what they did is they organized the 13 different signals that went to the 13 different exchanges so they all arrived at exactly the same time. So they weren't vulnerable to a high-frequency trader seeing they'd arrived to buy at one exchange and racing them to all the other exchanges. And the minute they were able to perfect this, and it was not a simple matter, designing it so that they arrived at the same time at all these exchanges. And it was not even intuitively obvious to them that it was a solution to the problem. They were guessing. They'd been experimenting in the markets, and this was just one of their experiments. But when they hit the button and all their buy orders arrived at exactly the same, you know, microsecond at all 13 exchanges, the market became the market again. No longer was the high-frequency trader able to identify what they were doing at the first exchange they arrived at and exploit them on all the other exchanges. So this was a revelation. This was the beginning. This is, in a way, it's the beginning of their story because it's the first time they see, oh my God, now we know how we're being exploited. We're being exploited because the first exchange we arrive at, there are predators waiting who identify what we're doing and then prey on us at all the other exchanges. And they take this. I think this is like, there's several moments where there are these moral choices that my main character, that Brad, has to make. And the minute he realizes this, he realizes he sees that the game is being played. He has a choice. He can play the game with everybody else, and he could probably make a lot of money as a high-frequency trader. But instead, he decides to go on an educational campaign and go talk to investors about what he's just discovered.
And, of course, a lot of them don't understand what's going on yet either.
But, you know, this is a big, big point. So there is this perception that Wall Street insiders understand how Wall Street works. And it's false. And it's especially false right now. That here you have this young man, this kid at the Royal Bank of Canada who's engaged in this kind of science experiment in the market. He figures out at least one angle the predators are taking. And he goes and talks to not just ordinary investors. He's talking to Bill Ackman, David Einhorn, Dan Loeb, Fidelity, Vanguard, Capital Group, the biggest investors, the smartest investors in the world, and their jaws are on the floor. Bill Ackman, the hedge fund manager who often, you know, takes big stakes in companies, he told me, he said, you know, until Brad Katsuyama walked into my office, I thought I had an insider trading problem. I thought people were figuring out what companies I wanted to buy and jumping in front of me in the market before I bought them. And it was a different kind of insider trading problem than I thought I had, basically, is what he said. So these people have no idea what's going on in the market and are being educated by this Canadian who's basically just arrived on the scene and has decided to make understanding his business.
So when we left off, you were talking about how Brad Katsuyama, who's the central figure in your book, had figured out how high-frequency trading was kind of becoming predatory and exploiting his trade so that he ended up having to buy at higher prices than he thought he was buying. And he brings a team of people together from around the country who really understand insider trading, and they try to figure out a way of circumventing it. They come up with a program that levels the playing field. And then they figure out what they really need to do is create their own stock exchange. Why would they need to do that?
Well, because what they realized was that the American stock exchanges had completely fallen down on their responsibility to create a fair environment for investors, that they were prejudicing the market in favor of high-frequency traders because the high-frequency traders pay them to do it. And that was, in fact, kind of the business model of the American stock exchange, was to create opportunities for extremely fast traders to exploit you and me and every other investor. As so long as the exchanges were bent on doing this, no matter how cleverly they routed their stock market orders into the market, that they figured that the predator would find a way to get them. And so the solution to the problem, they thought, was, well, let's create an actual fair stock exchange. Let's take on the responsibility of essentially restoring trust to the stock market, of creating an environment where every dollar stands the same chance. I mean, who would have thought this would be such a radical act? But it is. And so they design an exchange on which high-frequency traders can operate, but they don't have any speed advantage anymore.
So this new exchange that was started by the central figure in your book, Brad Katsuyama, how has it performed so far?
It was initially named the Investors Exchange, and then they went to go get a web address, and they realized that it was www.investorssexchange.com. It bothered them right from the beginning. They had to introduce another acronym to Wall Street, IEX, and it bothered them no end. But IEX was open for business in late October of 2013. And it's done extremely well as new exchanges go. Normally, the new exchanges take a while to gain traction. They're already profitable. I mean, they're trading, I don't know, 30, 40 million shares a day, which is still – it's small, but it's sustainable. The volume of stock market trading they're doing, though, is really a very poor indication of their effect on the universe, because their effect has been profound. The New York Stock Exchange for the last 3 months has been trying to buy them. And I think there's a chance the New York Stock Exchange will buy them and try to make them the New York Stock Exchange. What they are is they're radically disrupting the environment, because investors are increasingly learning that it is the one fair exchange. It's the one place where they won't be exploited. And the pressure that investors put on banks and brokers to send their stock market orders to this exchange is increasing. And at some point, it's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like a river changing its course. And I think you can kind of think of Brad Katsuyama and IEX as sort of trenching on the side of a river that may want to jump its bank at that particular bend. That at some point, the whole market could jump onto this exchange. That there's a kind of network effects, that the bigger they get, the bigger they get. And it's all been good. I mean, they've doubled in size every month since they started, and I suspect that they're going to continue to do so for a while.
So this high frequency trading that has created the unequal playing field that you write about, this all happened after the financial collapse of 2007, right?
Yes, and that is an incredible footnote to the story. The idea that essentially, the stock market got rigged since the financial crisis. You would have thought that here you got the world's most watched, most supposedly democratized, politicized financial market at a time when everybody is skeptical about Wall Street. You would have thought that that would be the least likely time for these sort of shenanigans to happen. But in fact, no. In fact, there's been a dramatic rise of predatory activity since the financial crisis in the stock market.
You know, it was algorithms and things invisible to the public and to most traders that created the financial collapse of 2007, or at least partly created it. Are experts expecting that there are going to be more flash crashes in the near future because of how complicated and also covert so much of high-frequency trading is now?
The answer to that is yes. You look around. There's a flash crash. There are flash crashes in stocks every day, individual stocks. There are outages at the exchanges. There's technical glitch after technical glitch. This is all symptomatic of a system that's out of control, too complicated. Nobody completely understands it. It's unstable. And Goldman Sachs, in just the last few weeks, has essentially thrown its support behind Brad Katsuyama's exchange because they think that what is needed is simplicity and transparency. And they're starting to route all their customers' orders onto that exchange for that reason. And the head of Goldman Sachs' stock market division said to me, he said, if we don't change the system, there's going to be a flash crash times 10. There's going to be some extremely unpleasant crisis in the stock market. So I think it's becoming conventional wisdom that the system itself is a problem. And that's a problem for all of us because if the system is unstable, if the house is built on sand, it does not engender trust. And if there is not trust in the market, it costs companies more to raise money in the market. And if it costs companies more to raise money in the market, they don't supply as many jobs to the economy. They don't innovate in the way they might innovate. They don't invest in the way they might invest. And it's a problem that gets to the very, very root of the American economy.
part of the reason why you're so good at reporting on Wall Street is that you used to work there. So you were an insider for a while. And this was in the mid-1980s when you
A long time ago.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's changed a lot since then. But still, you grasp it. So this was in the mid-80s. You worked at Salomon Brothers. You were there during the crash of October 87. You say Wall Street firms have grown more concerned than they were in the late 80s with what journalists might say about them. Why do you think that is, and how did that affect your reporting of this high-frequency trading story?
It's interesting because if you think back what I did with Liar's Poker, I walked out of a job at Salomon Brothers, told my bosses I was going to write a book about Wall Street, and they kind of smiled and said, go do it if you want to. You're crazy because you make a lot more money here, but you know, do your best kind of thing. If you try to do that now, well, for a start, the version of me on Wall Street would have signed all kinds of non-disclosure agreements when he came into the firm. And you would have been hounded by lawyers on your way out the door. The firms have become so concerned about their public faces and so reluctant to share what's going on inside of them. Now, why has that happened? I think it's because Wall Street, to some extent, depends for its profits on people not understanding what's going on in Wall Street. The firms generate complicated situations, complicated securities, precisely so that other people don't understand them, creating an advantage for the Wall Street firms. I think that technology has naturally rendered a lot of what Wall Street's formerly useful function was moot, that you don't need a human being in between buyers and sellers of stock anymore. It could all be done electronically without Wall Street in between the buyers and the sellers. So Wall Street has been put in a position of having to scramble to find sources of revenues that are just less justified, that are more kind of manufactured. Subprime mortgage CDOs are one example. The incredibly complicated things they did in the subprime mortgage market were not actually economically useful. They were damaging, but they generate a lot of profits for Wall Street. This breathtakingly complicated stock market that's been constructed is not actually socially or economically useful, but it generates a lot of money for Wall Street. So when you are running one of these firms and you sense that a lot of what you do is not socially or economically useful, it's just enabling a kind of skim, the last thing you want is transparency or people from the inside talking about what's going on in the inside. You want to hide what you're doing. I mean, I think they're naturally kind of more frightened of having the public genuinely understand what their businesses are. And it's not that all the business on Wall Street is bad or not useful, but it's just an increasing chunk of Wall Street is essentially predatory. So I think that's what's going on. And I think that the sort of technology has caused a crisis in the financial services industry, and the financial services industry has responded by, you know, trying to defend its profitability. And it's been very good at doing it, but it requires this kind of opacity.
Michael Lewis speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. His new book is called Flash Boys. High-frequency trading is currently being investigated by the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and New York's Attorney General.
He got a glint in his eye, a satellite cross in the sky. See yourself flying so high, you're gonna climb that wall.
John Langford is a Welsh-born, Chicago-raised singer-songwriter who began his career in the punk rock culture of the 1970s as part of the Mekons. He's led or been a member of numerous bands, including the Waco Brothers and the Pine Valley Cosmonauts. Langford's latest release is with another of his bands, Skull Orchard. The album's packaging also contains some of his paintings. Langford is a prolific artist. The new collection is called Here Be Monsters. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
John Langford has spent his career illuminating lives that get ignored in celebrity culture, pointing out what he perceives as lies in political culture, and asserting himself with boldness and a rough sense of humor into art culture. In addition to writing and performing songs, he's also an excellent artist. He's made a painting to accompany every song in the Here Be Monsters CD package, And I highly recommend a 2006 book of his paintings and writings called Nashville Radio. And of course, I'm here to recommend this new album of his, Here Be Monsters, a collection that finds creative ways to dramatize man's impulse to destroy.
Sometimes life will spring up all around you. Imagination's all you really need. Your plans and your ideas have just begun. The future's sweet as sugar on your tongue. And you watch a film alone and feel like crying. Seems like every game you play, they let you win. Going out to the pub and drink some rum and learn how other people get things done.
Langford has frequently placed his left-wing politics front and center in his music and his art. One of the most overtly political songs on this new album is Drone Operator. Langford assumes the character of a man who oversees drone strikes, the song's pretty melody at odds with its harsh criticism of this man's job and the current administration's use of that labor.
I'm not really a soldier. I'm more likely to die. By cardiac cancer than an eye in the sky that follows them home, riding in through their window. And they'll never know. They'll never know. When I was a young boy.
Now in his 50s, Langford started out in punk and settled into country music for a good long time, but this new album is a bit of a break from both of those genres. These are more like folk songs with rock and roll instrumentation, hard rock with sentiments that can be sung in a soft voice, but whose ideas are never soft-headed.
Never found a subject so much to my liking. All the puff pieces and picks of the week, never got it right.
Never came close.
They always miss the point. I'm disappointed, misrepresenting me. They can't see my head. There's so many mansions full of blinding sights. A beautiful poetry. Now all the doors are locked and I'm the only one with keys. No one else deserves the chance to solve. And these puzzles
beyond
and mysteries.
Beyond your reach, beyond your grasp, beyond your help.
I'm beyond your reach, beyond your grasp, beyond your help. Lost in the endless.
Beyond your grasp, beyond your help.
Fascination with myself.
On the beautiful song I just played, Langford and his band Skull Orchard describe a useless kind of artist, someone who creates work to be admired, to be envied, and to serve as the basis for hero worship. This is the precise opposite of what Langford has been doing since the 70s. He'd probably say that's partly because he's never become a big-time pop star. But it also has to do with a life spent making music that understands the best thing about pop is its democratic quality, that it can inspire everyone who hears it to make his or her own kind of imaginative work. For Langford, making your life your art is the highest possible goal to achieve.
Ken Tucker reviewed John Langford's new album, Here Be Monsters. Coming up, how to clean things we don't talk about in polite conversation, but apparently do talk about on the radio. We get some tips from Jolie Kerr, author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. This is something Jerry Seinfeld used to say in his act back in the 80s.
Now they show you how detergents get out bloodstains on television. Pretty violent image there. I think if you got a t-shirt with bloodstains all over it, maybe laundry isn't your biggest problem right now.
What Seinfeld said may be true, On the other hand, let's not underestimate the importance of getting out those bloodstains. Our next guest, Jolie Kerr, is known for giving advice on dealing with unconventional, embarrassing, and gross housekeeping and laundry problems, which is why her new book is titled My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha, as in Martha Stewart. Kerr also writes the column Ask a Clean Person, which originated on the feminist website Jezebel and is now on the women's website The Hairpin and the sports site Deadspin. She spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Jolie Kerr, welcome to Fresh Air. So in preparation for this interview, I collected questions from the Fresh Air staff about cleaning, and we also asked for some questions from our listeners, so we have lots of questions for you. And the first question is going to be from our executive producer, Danny Miller, and he is actually asking a question on behalf of Travis Bickle, who is the main character in Martin Scorsese's classic masterwork, Taxi Driver. for anyone who's seen Taxi Driver, they know that Travis is a very lonely, alienated taxi driver who thinks the world he sees around him is full of filth and filthy people and crazy people, and he thinks of himself as the sane and decent one when actually he's going crazy. So here's an excerpt of Travis Bickle's diary from Taxi Driver, and you'll see why we need your answer to this.
All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. Each night when I return the cab to the garage, I have to clean the back seat. Some nights I clean off the blood.
Okay, so the question is, what advice would you have for Travis Bickle on the nights when he has to clean off the blood from the back seat of his taxi?
That is a great question. The good news about cleaning blood is that there's actually a lot of ways that you can clean blood off of various surfaces. And the other good thing is that generally taxi seats are made out of vinyl, which is pretty easy to clean. Unlike leather or cloth, it's not as absorbent and it's not as difficult and testy as leather can be. So with vinyl, actually, you could just wipe it off. Generally speaking, though, you don't want to use bleach on blood. So he could have used something like hydrogen peroxide, which is a very common way to remove blood stains from various surfaces, including upholstery. There's another really funny one. I don't know that he would like this because it might sound really gross to him. It sounds kind of gross to me, but it does work, which is that your own saliva will clean out a blood stain. So for people who are on the fly and in a pinch and can't get access to any kind of cleaning product, have a blood stain on something, they can go ahead and spit right on the place where the stain is and rub it in a little bit, and that will take blood stains out.
So you said don't use bleach on a blood stain. Why not?
Generally speaking, you don't want to use bleach on a blood stain. You don't want to use bleach on any kind of protein stain. And my rule of thumb that I tell people is that if it comes out of you, so vomit, blood, saliva, sweat is another example, those fall into the category of protein stains. And oftentimes what happens with bleach when it comes in contact with a protein stain is that it can render that stain more yellow rather than taking it out.
Okay, well, so, this leads to a problem that women have, which is if you get blood stains on your sheets, I mean, if they're white sheets, maybe you'd want to bleach the sheets, but you're saying don't do that.
Yes, don't do that. Stick with the hydrogen peroxide as opposed to bleach. Again, it's got that same antibacterial property to it that bleach has, but it won't render that stain yellow. Hydrogen peroxide is really always the go-to when you're talking about blood stain. Although, as I said, there are a lot of other ways that you can go. Weird things from saliva to meat tenderizer with blood.
So say you're putting the sheet in the laundry. Are you putting in like a cup of hydrogen peroxide or just pouring that on the stain? What are you doing?
You should pre-treat the stain. Generally speaking, you don't want to just put your stain treatments into the wash cycle. You actually want to apply them right to the stain and let them work a little bit before laundering the item. That's going to give you the best results.
So would the same apply to what you describe so tastefully as sex stains on your sheets?
Yes, very much so. And sexual stains, which is, of course, my very nice term, are certainly one of the things that you absolutely never, ever want to put bleach on. It really is going to make those stains render much more yellow than they did even in their original state. And this is also very much true of sweat stains, those yellow stains that people tend to get under the underarms of their shirts. An enzymatic-based cleaner is going to be a go-to for that. I love OxiClean, that old infomercial product that a lot of people sort of blow off because of its infomercial past. There are lots of other enzymatic-based stain removers out there. Zout is one of them. Really, anything that has enzymes in it is going to go ahead and say that right on the label. So any kind of spray treatment, I find spray treatments are the easiest for people to work with. They're a little bit less messy than the gel sticks or making a paste out of a powder. But any of those are really fine as long as they have enzymes in them. And again, following that rule of thumb I gave you about the protein stain, whenever you're talking about a protein stain, the first thing you want to think about is I need an enzyme to counteract that.
Does everything that you just said also apply to the dreaded skid marks?
You know, skid marks, to some extent, skid marks are a little bit different, though. And I just said that so seriously, didn't I? It's a ridiculous thing to talk about. They're among the easiest stains to get out. Of course, they're gross, and we don't really want to think about them too much, but they do happen. The good thing about those kinds of stains is that really a little bit of soap and water is going to take them out. You don't even need to get super, super fancy. You know, you just have to maybe literally hold your nose and get a little soap and water, and just rubbing the fabric against itself will really help to ease a stain out.
So do that before you put it in the laundry.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Now, in talking about these stains, you mentioned underarm stains from sweat and deodorant. And we have two people on our show who wanted to know about that. One is a woman, Heidi Simon, and the other is a man, John Myers. And they're especially interested in white T-shirts and white shirts. So what advice do you have for getting out sweat and deodorant underarm stains?
Sure thing. Well, the first thing I want to say is that I love that that both a man and a woman ask that. It's actually probably my number one question, both from men and women. Total equality when it comes to pit stains. And they happen for two reasons, actually, which you kind of touched on. One, yes, it's the sweat that's causing that yellow stain. But the other thing is the deodorant that we're wearing, the antiperspirant that we're wearing, is causing those yellow stains. And that's in part because the aluminum that's in that antiperspirant and deodorant is reacting with the protein in our sweat and also the protein that's naturally in many of our clothes. The fibers, particularly in cotton shirts, have a protein element to it. So basically what you're getting is a perfect storm of chemical reactions going on with the deodorant, the shirt, and the sweat. So again, in that case, always an enzymatic cleaner, never bleach. But you can't just sprinkle a little OxiClean in the wash and expect a miracle. You are going to have to do a little bit of work.
You mean go ahead.
Pre-soak, which no one wants to hear. I'm sorry to have to report that. But pre-soaking those shirts in some warm water and whatever enzymatic cleaner you're using, give them a good long soak if they're really bad, will go a long way in getting those stains out. The other thing that you can use is either an old toothbrush or a laundry brush will help to really slough those stains out. So rubbing the pits of those shirts will help to lift a lot of the staining, but also the residual deodorant and antiperspirant that tends to build up. You get that kind of hard underarm feeling, that cardboardy feeling. That's really from the buildup of the deodorant.
Okay, so this next question comes from one of our producers, Phyllis Myers. She wants to know the truth about seltzer when it comes to using seltzer to spot clean a stain.
It works, for sure.
What does it work for?
You know, it can work for basically any stain. And the reason that it works really is that you're getting to it immediately with some water. And it's not so much that seltzer is so totally magic. The difference that seltzer has that flat water doesn't have is that it has some sodium in it. Sodium is a pretty good stain killer. Again, when we were talking about the blood stains, salt solution, saline solution, will work on blood stains. And as I think everybody who drinks wine knows, salt is the go-to when you have a red wine stain.
I didn't know that.
So, oh, well, now you know that. Yeah, when you have a red wine stain, just pouring a whole bunch of table salt on it will, like, suck it right up. It has to be
wait,
a fresh stain.
Table salt in water or just plain table salt?
No, just plain table salt.
Really?
Yeah, it's a weird phenomenon. And it's weird to see it happen because all of a sudden this mound of salt starts turning red. It's very cool. It's very cool.
Even if your fabric has already basically absorbed the wine?
As long as it's a fresh stain. That's for fresh wine stains.
Huh. And then you pour the salt on, the salt turns red, and then you're finished? Or then you take cold water or what?
Well, then you'll sweep or vacuum up the salt. So it's away. There'll probably be a little bit of a residual stain that can just be treated with a little bit of soap and water. If it's on a carpet cleaner, even a little bit of liquid laundry detergent.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. You could go home and pour some red wine on your carpet tonight and try it out.
No, thank you.
I didn't think you were going to do that. But back to the seltzer. So one of the reasons that seltzer works a little bit better than flat water is that it does have sodium content in it. The real notion behind it is that you're treating the stain right away, right? So you look down at your blouse, you go, oh no, I splashed a little bit of wine. You immediately dip your napkin into seltzer water and you start dabbing at it. It's really the dabbing with the water that's getting that stain out because you're getting to it before it's set in.
So it's not the carbonation from the seltzer that's accomplishing anything?
No.
Okay. So say you have a stain and all you have is water. It's the only thing you have available. Cold water is going to help?
Great. Absolutely. I always tell people, first thing to do when you get a stain, run the water, get a little dish soap, put a tiny bit of dish soap on the stain, run the garment under the running water while rubbing it together. That stain's going to come right out.
You know what I worry about when I do that? That the part where I've been rubbing with the soap, it's going to have its own stain. It's going to, like, the dye is going to run a little bit or something. It's going to look different than the rest of the garment.
No, I don't think you need to worry about that. Well, the thing is, you don't need to use a lot of soap. I mean, you don't want to get so sudsy that you can't rinse the shirt out, right? So just really a tiny, tiny bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, if it's a very delicate fabric, you don't want to rub it together so hard that you're abrading the fabric. But no, you shouldn't have any issue with dye run.
Okay. This question comes from me. If you have a towel that's gotten mildewed, what's the best way of getting the mildew out?
Ah, this is one of my favorite ones. So I'm going to tell you how to get the mildew out, and then I'm also going to tell you why that's happening. The first thing to know is the way to get it out is to run those towels through the washing machine, hot water, no detergent, and a cup of white vinegar. White vinegar is going to kill that mildew smell. The other thing that the white vinegar is going to do is it's going to help to remove the excess detergent and fabric softener from those towels. And that leads me right into the thing that is causing that mildew on the towels. What you're doing is you're using way too much laundry detergent when you're washing your towels. Everyone does this. I'm guilty of it too. We think that more detergent means more clean. That's not the case. What happens when you use too much detergent is that detergent doesn't fully get rinsed out. And I like to compare it to washing a plate with too much dish soap. When you use too much dish soap on a plate, think about how long it takes you to get the plate clean of the soap, right? In that case, though, you have time on your hands because it's up to you how long you're rinsing that plate, right? You can just stand there and wait and wait and wait until enough water has run down it so that it's clean. When it comes to the washing machine, you don't have control over the length of the rinse cycle. That's preset for you by nature of the machine. So it's rinsing out as much as it can in the time that it allows for the rinse cycle. And anything that's left over in those towels soap-wise is going to just hang out in there. Then you're going to dry them. They're going to come out of the machine smelling great. You're going to think you have fluffy, great towels. You're going to use it. You're probably going to use it again, which means you're going to hang it back up in your bathroom. The next day you go in and it smells like mildew. And the reason it smells like mildew is because your wet body has come in contact with that towel that has way too much soap still hanging around in it. And mildew loves two things. It needs a drink, and that's the water, and it needs food. And the food that it loves the most is it loves soap and it loves skin. And while it's been hanging up in your damp bathroom, it's just been having a grand old party, drinking and eating and being all mildewy, and that's why your towels smell. So to triage them, you want to run them through a wash cycle with vinegar and no soap to get that soap out. And then going forward, really try to cut back on the amount of detergent that you're using.
It strikes me as kind of cruel that mildew likes soap.
I know. Isn't it? Isn't it heartbreaking?
It just doesn't seem right.
I know. Dastardly, that mildew.
Okay. And a lot of people have this question. Do you have a recommendation for a slow drain in a sink?
I do.
Without using like one of the acid products?
Yes, I do. I do, and it's a fun one. So, yes, it actually is fun. It is fun. And this isn't just me being a crazy clean person who thinks that all cleaning is fun. This is actually a really fun one. So you're absolutely right to say without using one of those acid products. Commercial drain clearers can be very, very hard on your pipes. The other thing to know before, if you are going to use a commercial drain clearer, is that it is incredibly important to know what kind of drains you have. If you have metal drains or if you have PVC, because you can cause a huge amount of damage if you use the wrong kind of product for your drain type. So one way to avoid all of that is to use a very natural, all totally safe and very, very fun method for clearing a slow drain. Now, I should say that this is probably not going to work when you've gotten to the point of a fully backed up drain. This is really for the slow drain and also for drain maintenance in general. So it's a combination of baking soda and white vinegar, and that is going to produce the very fun volcano effect. So when a lot of us were in grammar school, our science classes would have us do the baking soda and vinegar volcano, which is where you put a whole bunch of baking soda down, and then you pour vinegar over it, and it has this huge, cool, bubbling up explosion type effect. It's not going to explode so much that it's going to go all over the bathroom, so you don't need to worry about that. But it is really cool to watch, and I do this in my house, and it's very fun. Always gives me a little thrill.
How much of it are you using?
You know, a good sprinkle. I mean, usually I'm doing it out of the box of baking soda. So, you know, maybe four or five good sprinkles, and then just pour maybe a half cup to a cup of white vinegar. I sort of eyeball it.
And then do you rinse it all down afterwards?
Yeah, then just, you know, let that kind of work and run down the drain for a little bit and work its magic. About 5-10 minutes later, go in and just run hot water down, push it all the way through the drain, help to clear things out.
Okay, good. Thank you for that.
I told you it was fun.
As these things go, it sounds like fun. Julie Kerr, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun and helpful.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Julie Kerr is the author of the new book, My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.